On this show, we're all about bringing to the forefront the concepts of galactic awareness and animal awareness and how these concepts can help us bring about a wonderful future for our civilization. You have years of experience in the fields of ufology and what I call galactic awareness and have written many books, including Space Force or Star Trek Future, Antarctica's Hidden History, U.S. Air Force Secret Space Program, Galactic Diplomacy, Getting to Yes with the ET, among other books. And based on everything that you've researched and everything that you found out and all this awesome journey of ufology and galactic awareness, give us your thoughts about humanity's preparedness in regards to interactions with star people.
Well, that's a very interesting question, and people without realizing it are prepared insofar as they have all absorbed the popular culture. And in the popular culture, whether we're talking about movies, television series, there is a lot of information out there about extraterrestrial life. And people have absorbed all of that at an emotional level, and also in terms of their imagination and the possibilities of what's out there. Now, intellectually, though, people are not prepared because the groundwork has not been laid. What we've had is many decades of disinformation, ridicule, and an attempt to eschew anyone from any serious field to look into this topic. So that means that when we look at all of the professional levels, whether we're talking about universities, whether we're talking about the mainstream media, whether we're talking about legislatures, Congress, whether we're talking about the military, very, very few people are intellectually prepared for this. They have no idea as to the history and the depth of the extraterrestrial presence and the level of interaction that has been happening with our planet. And so that's going to be the biggest shock. But at an emotional level, people are ready because everyone loves to watch, whether it's Star Trek or whether it's like Stargate, SG-1, and of course the popular movies that are out there, Independence Day and so forth. People have taken the information in at that emotional level, but intellectually, very little preparedness.
So do you think, based on what you just said, you think there's a chance that people can find a way to accept once information is given at a, at a different type of level, maybe governmental level, that we're certainly not alone? Do you think that the shock would be too great or that people would just go on with their lives because people have complicated lives? Do you think there's a chance at a smooth transition?
Well, we have to look at it in terms of generations. I mean, I think your generation and probably your audience, you guys will be able to absorb it and ride that wave and be ready to embrace the possibilities that it brings in. My generation, people who are kind of like pretty much at the end of their careers, they're not prepared. It's going to come as a huge shock. Many of them are going to be very, very depressed because they're going to feel that their whole life has been wasted. Because they're going to feel that, especially physicists and engineers, people who have thought that the laws of physics, as we understand it, are immutable, they're going to find out that that was never true, that there is much more to a lot of the ideas that were eschewed as like they were just dismissed as kind of tinfoil hat, the ideas of, say, like anti-gravity, zero-point energy, the possibility of using torsion fields for faster-than-light travel. People believe, have been brought up to believe that the speed of light is the fastest that you can attain. And so when they find out that extraterrestrials regularly travel, that we have extraterrestrials traveling to our planet, from distant star systems, like on a daily basis, like you would commute from the suburbs of New York to New York City in like an hour, that extraterrestrials do that from the Pleiades or from Alpha Centauri, that they come here and they do whatever they need to do and then they go back. That requires kind of energies of that requires propulsion technologies and the ability to bend space-time that many professionals, physicists, engineers, just didn't think possible. And so they're going to be very depressed when they realize that a lot of this means that everything that they believed all their lives wasn't true.
Well, I sure hope with all my heart that people can heal, because I think I understand what you're saying about the depression that could ensue. But they definitely don't travel in a linear way that we can imagine. It's a little different. So now, for a while now, I have come to the conclusion that our planet is going through a cosmic transition. I'm sure, well, you've come to that conclusion a long time ago, which is complicated to explain. I term the process the upcoming protocols of galactic interaction. So what comes to mind to you when I say upcoming protocols of galactic interaction? Please elaborate what comes to mind.
Well, we have to understand that extraterrestrials have been visiting us and studying us for a long, long time, kind of similarly to the way in which we might study primitive forest peoples in the jungles of the Amazon, where you don't want to intrude and intervene and disrupt their lives because you believe it's important for them to be able to live without being disrupted in any way. So extraterrestrials come here, and many of them are studying us and watching and really don't want to disrupt us in any kind of overt way. They want us to develop under our own steam, but they also understand that, you know, we have a corrupt leadership, a leadership that has made deals and agreements with some unethical extraterrestrial races. And so, you know, this is where the kind of like principle of non-intervention becomes a little blurred, because in their protocols, it's permissible to intervene if another extraterrestrial species has also intervened and brought about damage. And so part of their protocols is to be able to come in and rectify the damage. And so this has been the kind of dynamic behind the scenes, that we have different extraterrestrial groups, some being very scrupulous in terms of upholding their protocols and their principles of interaction, but others being very unscrupulous. Kind of, you know, and again, we can use the analogy of like the Amazon and the forests, the people that live, the tribes that live in the Amazon. You got, say, the scientists that want to study them and not interfere with their habitat. But on the other hand, you have like those that want to come in and cut down the trees because they want to use the trees for the wood industry and so forth. And so there's a kind of dynamic there, and it's very complex. But definitely with the extraterrestrials, they do have their protocols for interacting with a developing planet like ours.
Oh, yeah, that's a wonderful analogy. I think it's very clear for anybody with the comparison between humble people from the Amazon and, you know, Western people and how they would interact with each other. And that brings me to, now that we're talking about humble people that live in the forest, have you seen the film Aluna, A-L-U-N-A? It's a film that depicts the Kogi people that live in northern South America. And they are very humble people that somehow they've been able to be outside the European influence for their entire lives. They lived in the mountains in northern South America. And basically, the film Aluna, it depicts their efforts to raise the planetary frequency of consciousness. I think it's fascinating because a lot of people in our world, in our developed world, a lot of them, a lot of us don't really see that people that humble, that don't have access to computers or technology or anything, that they can be so aware of the cosmos and how they just accept that we're part of this massive system. And so have you seen that film? Have you heard about the Kogi?
I haven't seen that film, but I'm aware a little bit about Indigenous peoples around the world and how they are very much in alignment with their habitats, and they are very humble, and that they are able to communicate, interact with off-planet beings, and that this is often part of their culture.
Yeah, on this same train of thought, what do you know, based, again, on all your research and your experience, what do you know about humble Native American people, either from Northern or South America or Central America, who accept that we're part of a cosmic system and that we are due to return to our ancestors, as they call them, or our cosmic family? What can you tell us about their work and, you know, like, what do you know? Tell us.
Sure, I think it's a very common thing with a lot of the Indigenous peoples from around the world that they have their oral traditions that go back many, many centuries and millennia. And in these oral traditions, they often talk about extraterrestrials and how they interact, have been interacting with humanity. And in some of these oral traditions, especially I think with the Americas in particular, what you have is the memories of the times before the great catastrophe. We're talking about the flood, you know, some cataclysmic event that happened around 11,000 years ago, that they talk about the off-world or the extraterrestrials arriving and helping humanity find safety in underground caves. And that at the end of the cataclysms, they were able to come out with the help of the extraterrestrials and start building their civilizations again. So you do have these oral traditions where extraterrestrial life is a rich aspect. And of course, also you have the out-of-body experiences as well. I mean, that's another aspect. They're like the shamans, like especially in South America where they use ayahuasca and other kind of like mind expansion drugs, they are able to have out-of-body experiences where they meet and interact with extraterrestrials in their astral or etheric bodies. So that's another aspect to their kind of culture, and that's what makes them so prepared for what's coming, because they've been told that there would be a time of cleansing, a time of great change, and that we are in that period right now.
Yeah, wonderful. Yeah, time of cleansing and great change, and we're in that period right now. So what do you think is the role of youth in the upcoming Protocols of Galactic Interaction, specifically those youth who have a fascination, kinship, and automatic remembrance of our galaxy being kind of our primary home? I mean, we're all inside the galaxy, but, you know, it seems that on our planet, we are very, I guess, self-centered, culturally speaking, globally, and we don't really see what's outside. It seems that planet Earth is so busy that people just don't have time, to ponder about the galaxy because there's so much going on here. So, again, what do you think is the role of those youth, that they feel this kinship and connection to the galaxy, and that we accept that the galaxy is already filled with ancient life and order? What do you think is their role?
I think the biggest role for the youth is one of just being open and excited about embracing extraterrestrial life and being a part of a bigger galaxy, or being part of life outside of our planet at a galactic level. Because, you know, that's what's necessary now, is that our consciousness as a planet has to expand from, you know, being focused exclusively on planetary affairs, where we now start to look at what's happening in the other planets. You know, you take, for example, you know, climate change. You know, people are focused on climate change on planet Earth and looking at that, but, you know, in a way that's very myopic, because climate change is happening on all planets. I mean, there are other planets, you know, Neptune, Uranus, and Mars even. Climate change is happening there because our sun actually is the big generator and regulator of atmosphere or of patterns of climate in our solar system. And so you need to expand your mind and think of, like, oh, okay, our solar system actually is very reflective of what's happening under the sun. And so I think that's where the youth can actually play a big role in expanding our consciousness, you know, like this, like awareness of the importance of climate change, but now looking at it from the perspective of our entire solar system. So, you know, what is it that impacts climate in our solar system? Well, it's the sun. And so, you know, how does the sun behave? How is that impact? And so I think just that willingness to look at new ideas and embrace the big picture and do it with enthusiasm and joy, I think that's the biggest gift the young generation can bring as we move into this new phase of our planetary civilization.
Yeah, that's wonderful. Enthusiasm and joy, and hopefully we'll be able to maintain this openness. I don't think we can't even stop it. Many of us, we just can't stop it. We know what's happening. And thanks to trailblazers like you, like others that I've had on this show, you know, the information has been there to trigger remembrance, galactic remembrance, as I call it. So on this show, and a critical part of my personal journey is to speak about animal awareness, the animal beings. That's I like to call them animal beings as a reminder to people that they are beings like ourselves. So I believe animal awareness and the appreciation of animal beings is a crucial aspect in understanding what eternal spirit actually is, or what spirit actually is and how it behaves, what our galaxy actually looks like. So what comes to mind, again, based on everything that you've researched and all the people that you've talked, all the insiders, what comes to mind when I say animal awareness in terms of this evolution that we're going through as a planet?
Well, I think we have to kind of like grow out of our myopic focus of humans being the only intelligent species on the planet, and accept that there are other intelligent species on the planet that exceed us in intelligence. I mean, you look at the whales and you look at the dolphins, the cetaceans. I mean, their intelligence is greater than ours. And the problem is that we think of tool-making capacity as the mark of intelligence. So if you can make tools and make technology, then you're intelligent. But of course, with the whales and the dolphins, I mean, they don't make tools. They have these very powerful brains where they are able to manifest things through consciousness. And one of the things that is quite remarkable is that dolphins and whales actually have a lot of communications with extraterrestrial civilizations, that a lot of extraterrestrial civilizations communicate with the cetaceans because they recognize them as the custodians of the seas, of the oceans. And our planet is like 70% ocean. So, you know, we in our arrogance think, well, humans are like the dominant species on planet Earth, but, you know, we only inhabit like just over 30% of the surface. But it's the cetaceans that inhabit the other 70%, and extraterrestrials view them as being much more intelligent. And in terms of their brain capacity, they can do things through consciousness. Now, you know, I had the joy of living in Hawaii for 17 years, and I used to swim with the dolphins and occasionally have interactions with the whales. And there were many, many benefits of swimming with the dolphins and the whales. I mean, one of the first things is that it truly is, it's like, how can you prepare for meeting with an extraterrestrial? Well, I think that the closest way to do it is to go into the natural environment of an intelligent animal or marine life like dolphins or whales and just immerse yourself in their environment, because then you get to have an experience which kind of like prepares you for what will eventually happen when extraterrestrials openly arrive. And I was very fortunate to have those encounters with the dolphins and with the whales. And, you know, I still remember those experiences. They're very vivid, especially with the whales. And I have no doubt that these animals are very ancient. They have incredible intelligence, and that they are already in contact with extraterrestrials. And we on planet Earth are kind of a little slow.
Yeah, that's magnificent. I think you were definitely very fortunate to be able to swim with whales and dolphins. I have never done that in this lifetime, but I've always felt this kinship to them, and I do respect them a lot. But the past couple of months, I've come to also the understanding that animals such as our pets, cats and dogs, are actual, you know, I think it's hard for many people to see them as beings that can uphold wisdom, because they can be small and cute and all they do is play and sleep, and it's easy to just see that part of their behavior and not see that they actually carry wisdom. So what I'm trying to say is that the past couple of months I've realized that I've come to the conclusion that cats and dogs and all animals probably, but specifically cats and dogs that are the animals that are so close to us personally, that they actually are also carriers of this, I call it, I guess, animal, primal animal wisdom that is based, you know, it's not intellectual, it's not with words, it's pure and it comes straight from source. I mean, I felt it so strongly the past few months with my cat and with other pets I've seen, that they have this direct connection to source, and if you try to feel that interaction, one can actually realize that they can provide wisdom, that they can provide they can be our guides. I want to share that with you because the past couple of months I've talked to people that, well, their jobs are being animal communicators. And it's a field of study that is fascinating to me. And yes, they all agree that yes, cats and dogs, they can be cute and all, and horses, but they actually are here to be our guides because they're not, they don't get confused like we can, because we have all this intellect and the world is like oppressive, you know, and it's all this stuff, and they don't have that. What are your thoughts on that, on cats and dogs and pets and how they can be our guides during, well, in any space in time, but especially during this transition?
Yeah, I think the animals, especially our pets, can be very mindful of what's happening around them. And if you pay attention to them, then you can get a lot of information that can help guide you. And, you know, this is part of the kind of greater awareness of, say, the indigenous peoples, who understood that the animals would communicate with them and that nature would communicate with them, and that if you see an animal come by at a certain time, like a bird flying by at a certain time, you know, what were you thinking at that moment? And that thought at that moment and that bird, it's like, well, then you have some synchronicity. And, you know, our encounters with animals, whether it's with a pet or with a wild animal, I think they're all very meaningful. And the more we grow in awareness, I agree with you. I think that the animals are guides. They have that potential to help us connect with the spirit world, because, you know, we are so wrapped up as a civilization in intellectual abilities, in problem solving and tool making, that we are often disconnected from the emotional and the spiritual side. But the animals are the opposite. They are much more connected to the emotional, to the spiritual side. So in a way, they're our mirror opposites. And so that's where, if you find some balance where you can appreciate that, you can learn from them just as we, you know, provide for them and care and whatever it is that we do to kind of like support animal life in our communities or on the planet.
Yes, animal awareness to the top. So now let's chat about a concept that I've talked about on my show for about a year, and it's the concept of galactic law. You know, I've had, the whole idea come to me and remembering and stuff. And have you come across this concept of galactic law in your research? And regardless of you coming across or not, what comes to mind when I speak about galactic law? Please elaborate. Take your time.
Sure. Well, you know, I mean, there's two types of law when it comes to life in the galaxy. I mean, there's human law, you know, like we call it space law, and there are a number of international treaties that have been set up to regulate humanity's expansion into space, you know, to like the Outer Space Treaty from 1967. I mean, that's to kind of like ban the use of weapons of mass destruction in Earth orbit, to prevent the militarization of space, creating military bases on the moon and so forth. You know, that's kind of space law, and that's human law that's projected out. But then we have the galactic law from the perspective of extraterrestrials. And from my studies, they definitely have laws. They definitely watch exactly how a species like ours is developing and how other extraterrestrials come in. So, you know, one of the principles of galactic law is that extraterrestrials can only come in if there's some agreement. That if you're an advanced extraterrestrial species visiting a world like ours, which technologically is still in a developing stage, you can't just come and just take over the planet. You know, galactic law requires that if you arrive here, you need to have the agreement of the planet. And so this is what's happened. You know, there's been secret agreements that have been signed. And galactic law also applies to other more positive extraterrestrials who are looking at our planet. And as I discussed before, they have a law of non-intervention. So they don't intervene, because in galactic law, you can't disrupt a planet's natural evolutionary process. But then they look at us and they look at what's happened, because our corrupt leaders have made agreements, secret agreements with some extraterrestrials, and have allowed them to come in, and they've been doing things in laboratories in terms of genetic experiments and reverse engineering advanced spacecraft. So some galactic civilizations look at that and say that is a violation of galactic law, that, you know, humanity is still developing. Like, you wouldn't give a cigarette lighter to a toddler, to a two-year-old toddler. You wouldn't give a cigarette lighter to that toddler, because it's just too dangerous. Similarly, giving advanced technologies for a species such as ours, where ethically and morally we haven't yet developed greatly, but you give us or help us develop weapons of mass destructions like atomic bombs or thermonuclear weapons, or even more powerful torsion field weapons that can disrupt the space-time continuum. You know, these are all violations of galactic law. So, yeah, there's definitely different levels of galactic law, whether we're looking at it purely from the human side or whether we're looking at it from the extraterrestrial side.
Okay, so, yeah, what can you tell us about the aspects of galactic law that deal with correction of negative interference on evolving planetary societies such as Earth? What can you tell us about that, Alec?
Okay, that's a very good question. Well, you know, from what I know of this, the positive extraterrestrials that are viewing our planet, they can intervene to prevent any kind of like a catastrophe that is brought about because of, say, negative extraterrestrial intervention. And they can kind of intervene to mitigate the damage that's caused from this extraterrestrial intervention. And they do that by having their people infiltrate our planet. Often what they'll do is have human-looking extraterrestrials integrating our society. And so that means that, you know, whatever country you're in, often there are people living there who actually are extraterrestrials, who have infiltrated and are observing and trying to develop a plan for helping humanity develop our consciousness, develop our ethics, so that we can be ready for joining galactic life. Because, you know, there are basic principles that they abide by, which is that you have a service to other mindset, which is that it's all about trying to help others rather than dominating others. That is the characteristic of more aggressive imperialistic races. And so the more benevolent races, they want to develop that service to other mindset. So they kind of like encourage our humanitarian efforts. They encourage the development of free energy technologies or advanced healing technologies that can lift the quality of life on planet Earth. And so they tend to focus on that, whereas the other extraterrestrial groups tend to work with the military. They want to create super soldiers. They want to create artificial intelligence so that they could develop more effective weapons of war. And so we have very different ethics by different extraterrestrial civilizations trying to influence humanity to go in one direction or the other.
Yeah, and in regards to galactic law, I've had both remembrance and also information given to me about the importance in our galaxy and, well, I guess you might say, we might say creation, the importance of biospheres, of natural biospheres like Earth. We're used to knowing that, well, our planet is beautiful. You know, I mean, it's pretty messed up, we can all agree, but the parts that are still untouched, you know, regardless of whatever forest in North America or South America or Africa or Australia or even China, that these biosphere natural areas, they are the containers of life. They're the most important thing for the, I guess you might say, the people, the beings that seek to protect the galaxy or seek to uphold all the wonderful good principles of love and eternal life and everything great. So based on that, you know, based on the fact that for them, the protection of biospheres, of life forms, of the source of, we might say, it might sound a little too deep for many, but we might say it's the source of beauty, the source of poetry, in that the protection of that is very, very important. What is your opinion about that in terms of galactic law and how that is related to the protection of biospheres, of what makes the galaxy alive, the trees, the forests, the beings?
Yes, that's another very interesting question. I mean, the galactics look at our planet, and of course, we have these vast oceans, approximately 70% of the surface is covered by oceans, and we have the land, the continents. And the extraterrestrials, of course, they are very interested in our biosphere and helping it deal with whatever problems arise. And, of course, I think that they look at the biosphere as something which is very beautiful and worthy of protection. But what they do is they recognize, well, you know, who are the custodians of the biosphere? As far as the surface is concerned, humanity is the custodian. And so they look to humanity and say, well, what are we doing that might damage the biosphere? And they will try to encourage us to come up with solutions so that, you know, we don't destroy the rainforest so that we could get the wood, that we don't pollute the atmosphere with toxic chemicals and so forth that poison the food supply or that get dumped into the water supply. And also with the oceans, the extraterrestrials look at, well, who are the stewards of the oceans? And they see the cetaceans, that cetaceans have incredible intelligence. Actually, one of the things that's worth remembering is that back in 1961, when the search for extraterrestrial intelligence began, there was a workshop held in West Virginia at the first radio observatory, and they looked at the possibility of extraterrestrial life in our galaxy. And one of the factors that they identified was that on Earth there were two intelligent species. There was humans and there were cetaceans. So they recognized cetaceans as an intelligent species back in 1961. So this is something that the extraterrestrials also recognize, that the cetaceans are the custodians. I mean, if you listen to whales, the whale song, they can go, whales, when they sing, the frequency can carry for hundreds of miles. So the whales actually have a way of influencing the acoustics and in the oceans. The frequencies that are heard in the oceans, that they can alter the frequencies of the oceans in terms of their songs. So this is something that, you know, we on the surface don't really appreciate. But extraterrestrials recognize this. So what they do is they work with cetaceans in terms of the oceans and try to protect the oceans, the biosphere there. And they work with humans on the surface as best they can to try and encourage us to be responsible stewards for the surface of our planet and, of course, with the atmosphere too.
Yeah, and talking about humans, I want to talk about something that is fascinating to me because, well, of course, none of this information is ever on mainstream media, so we have to just search it. But we live in a time where it's okay. All the information is available. It's just a matter of going for it. But yeah, I want to talk about secret space programs. You wrote a book about it and everything, and a lot of people have talked about this. And it is, you know, basically, I think a lot of people have a hard time thinking about secret space programs because they trust the government, everything everybody says. But and I understand that there are reasons that certain governmental agencies have to maybe national security, all these different regulations they have. But I know that, well, if we went to the moon in 1969, that was a long time ago in my counting. And if people were able to go to the moon in 1969, then how come 40 years later or however long has passed, how come that we haven't, you know, we don't have stuff going on? So it's clear to me that we do have space programs that are classified because it's just logic. It's just, you don't even have to be too smart about it. It's just logic. That's how technology advances. I mean, we have cell phones that are about 1,000 times more powerful than the computer that made the little spaceship go to the moon in 1969. So yeah, tell us about these classified space programs. And, well, tell us a little bit about it. Just also try to speak to part of an audience that they're very, very much interested in learning about these classified space programs, but they don't know too much about it. And also, tell us, like, why? Why would they be classified? So much national security things to worry about?
Well, yes, a very complex field. You know, trying to put it in as simple a way as possible, you know, for those that maybe don't know too much about this, think of in the 1950s when different governments around the world began to reverse engineer some of the advanced technologies that they had acquired from crash sites involving extraterrestrial craft. And in the 1950s, you know, there was a concerted effort to reverse engineer these and to develop things like anti-gravity propulsion systems. So in the 1950s, we're talking 70 years ago, I mean, there's actually studies that show that anti-gravity was being seriously studied by a number of major corporations in the United States and Britain. But then it all went dark. It was like nothing else came out. And that's when it all became classified. And so what that means is that you know, typically in a university, the information you hear from the professors and you read in the textbooks, that's all open source information. And from that, you have engineering schools and schools of physics where you're taught things like how to make, say, a jet engine for, say, a rocket that can take us, say, to the moon. So that's all open source information, and that's something that, you know, people have access to. And what we also have is classified information, and that's where that's restricted to a tiny minority of people that have need-to-know access. And that's where you get to find out about these classified space programs, or these secret space programs as they're called, where they have reverse engineered some of the captured extraterrestrial technologies to build anti-gravity spacecraft. And so you're absolutely right in terms of the Apollo missions. The last Apollo mission was in 1972. That was Apollo 14. And so the Apollo program ended in 1972. Actually, there might have been a couple more after Apollo 14, but yeah, I can't remember exactly how many there were, but it ended in 1972, and then we don't have any more flights to the moon. Well, there were flights to the moon, but they were classified flights, of these reverse engineered spacecraft that had been developed by all the major corporations. Lockheed Martin, we're talking Northrop Grumman, we're talking General Dynamics. These major aerospace companies in the United States were secretly building these anti-gravity craft for different customers in the United States. And, you know, by customers, I'm talking about organizations like the United States Navy or the U.S. Air Force or the Central Intelligence Agency or the National Reconnaissance Office. So this is how the secret space program developed, so that as far as the open source literature was concerned, what you'd find in a university was information on how to build a rocket that could take you to the moon or take you, say, to Mars and so forth, which has been happening. But if you wanted to be able to take a lot of people and go for, say, a trip to Jupiter or a trip to Neptune, you would need some of these anti-gravity spacecraft. And these were being built secretly by the major corporations for different U.S. military and intelligence organizations. And other countries were doing the same thing. France, Britain, the Soviet Union or Russia, and China.
Well, I wish there weren't so many classified things in this world, but it seems that it's just the way the cookie crumbles here. But I'm really glad that the information is out there, and that we're becoming more and more ready as part of this transition, you know, to be able to accept this reality. So on that same train of thought, what are your thoughts on the recently established United States Space Force? Many insiders, as well as intuitives, believe it to be a platform to bring together many classified space programs or secret space programs, as well as unpublished technology. Does this make sense to you based on what you know, and how would this be useful?
Yes, this is a very important question, because I think the United States Space Force, it was created in 2019. It really was created with the intention of declassifying a lot of these advanced technologies that were built and used in the secret space programs. Because one of the problems that was found with the secret space programs was that military personnel that served in these classified programs for many years, that they wouldn't get the credits, they wouldn't get the kind of promotions, they wouldn't get the benefits that those in the conventional military professions would get. So if you were flying an F-22 Raptor for the U.S. Air Force, and you did hundreds of hours of flight time on that, you know, you'd get promotions, and if you used that in combat, you'd get promotions and so forth. But if you were part of the secret space program, because it was all classified, none of that could be used for promotions and for getting lots of benefits. So a lot of the people working in the secret space programs wanted to have their efforts recognized, and they wanted their programs to come into the kind of open source world. And so they were pushing for something like the creation of a space force. And so now what we have with the space force is that they're beginning the process of declassifying some of this advanced technologies, so that in the years ahead, we are going to have space force announcing the development of anti-gravity space technologies and making it sound as though this was brand new technology, and that Space Force is going to deploy fast anti-gravity spacecraft that could fly from the Earth to the Moon in like 30 minutes and make it sound like it was new. But in fact, they've had that technology for decades now, at least 3-4 decades now.
Well, I hope the United States Space Force can bring everything together for the days ahead. And talking about, the same thing, let's talk about a galactic union that seeks to protect all life forms and make sure planets are not destroyed. You know, the Galactic Federation of Worlds, as people call it, or many names for what I consider to be a heavenly celestial and magnificent galactic super alliance. What are your thoughts on our galactic federation?
Yes, there are different governing extraterrestrial organizations that are responsible for our solar system and, you know, all solar systems. And so Earth and our solar system have been recently being part of a kind of tug of war between competing extraterrestrial groups. But then you also have like another more highly evolved group. Some call that the Intergalactic Confederation. That's one of the names given to it. And it is kind of like an umpire, if you like. It's kind of like sets the rules for these other groups that will fight or struggle against one another in terms of who's going to have the most influence over planet Earth. But certainly, you know, we look at some of these extraterrestrial civilizations like the Galactic Federation of Worlds. They very much similar to us in terms of physiology. They look very human, and they are genetically related to us, and so they have a kind of a clear desire to help us evolve in a way where we can become part of the galactic community and join with them. There are other groups that are non-human with very different physiologies, and their intentions towards humanity is that, you know, we are a resource that can be used for whatever program that they have in mind. And so there's been a kind of tug of war between these different groups, and now we've got this new group having come in, the Interplanetary, the Intergalactic Confederation has come in to set the rules or to maintain universal law in terms of how the Earth evolves. And it seems that they do this just when a planet is on the verge of joining the galactic community. So, you know, the information I've been getting is that it's like the Earth is about to graduate, that we've gone through very difficult lessons, and the end result is that we haven't destroyed ourselves, that even though it's been very, very difficult, very, very challenging, there are enough humans that listen to one another, that are empathic and caring, and that are willing to come up with creative solutions to very difficult conflicts. And so because of that, we have gone through the last 50 years without imploding in a nuclear war, because there were very serious threats that there would be a nuclear war in the 1960s, that in the 1970s, again, there would be a threat of a nuclear war. And again, every few decades, there was a threat that humanity would have a cataclysmic war where the major powers would use nuclear weapons against each other. Well, that never happened. And the reason it never happened was that because there were enough good people in positions of authority to stop it from happening. And in the process, humanity's consciousness has grown. We've developed the internet, and so now we have connections with people all over the world. You know, you probably have friends in countries like China and Europe and Australia. You know, that's kind of pretty recent. And what that does is it creates these empathic bonds and connections all over the planet. So it means that we as a planet have come out of this very dangerous period where we could have so easily have ended up in a nuclear war, a third world war, where we destroyed much of the life on the surface of the planet. We've come out of that, and now we are about to enter the galactic age, because now we're ready to expand. We have Space Force. We have the Artemis Accords. I mean, the Artemis Accords are this set of bilateral agreements that have been signed with the United States, whereby all the like-minded democratic spacefaring nations are all going to collaborate and work together in colonizing space, in mining space, in extending the human presence far out into space, in creating a Star Trek future. So we are destined to become a galactic culture. and we're not going to implode. And so this is why now many different extraterrestrial councils are coming, because they're coming kind of like a graduation. You know, at a graduation ceremony, if you've gone through college, at the graduation, everyone comes. The president, the vice chancellor, all the VIPs for a university come to watch the graduates. So what we are having that happening right now with planet Earth, because we are about to graduate.
Oh, that's wonderful news. That's wonderful news. And I'm very happy that you speak so clearly about this. I just have a little statement, and it is that, you know, many people agree, despite what other people might think, that planet Earth is a very primitive planet. I think we've mentioned that regardless of our awesome technology and stuff, we're still considered primitive. However, with great potential, again, very primitive and barbaric. I mean, we have things that happen in this world that are just, it's incredible. So how would a star nation successfully reach out given our state of separation and quiet disarray?
Well, the star nations have been reaching out for many, many decades. Mm-hmm. And as I mentioned earlier, they actually have their people that have infiltrated human society and have been kind of like gently guiding us to greater awareness of extraterrestrial life and making people aware of a bigger galactic picture outside of just what is happening on Earth. So they have been reaching out to us, especially now. You know, when I've been talking, I mentioned secret space programs, and in the secret space programs, the level of interaction with extraterrestrial life is very, very high, which is not something that is publicly acknowledged. But within the secret space programs, they know all about extraterrestrials. They work often alongside extraterrestrials. And so they are very aware of this. But, of course, because these are all classified programs, they don't talk about it. So the extraterrestrials have been reaching out in those classified programs as well. And then finally, and something that we have to always be mindful of, is that extraterrestrials are telepathic. So they can reach out to us telepathically. So in our dreams, you might be actually having extraterrestrial contact in your dreams. And that's to prepare you for what's to come. So in your dreams, in a person's dreams, if you're having dreams of meeting with extraterrestrials, you know, this is probably not just imagination. You're probably really having those encounters at a kind of astral level. And that's like a precursor to direct physical contact. And that's often the way it happens. You know, I've studied quite a few contact cases where people had physical meetings with extraterrestrials, and most of them say it began as telepathic communications, that they would hear a voice in their head or they would have dreams of contact. And then as they got comfortable with the idea of contact, then they had the physical contact.
Oh, great. Yeah, that was just a reminder for everybody that contact has been happening already for a long time. And it's not like in the movies that it has to be a spaceship landing on the White House or anything like that. That it's, for lack of a better term, it's like a spiritual connection. So, yeah, would you like to tell us a little bit before we end this conversation for today? Would you like to tell us a little bit about your human journey? The most important memories that you have as a child or as a teenager that kind of opened you up to this field that I call galactic awareness, which is so, I mean, your work has been crucial, like the work of many others, to trigger many of us to galactic remembrance and, you know, knowing, doing what we have to do. And so tell us a little bit about what was the thing, maybe an animal companion, a friend, an experience that you had that opened you up to this, to your journey?
Very interesting question. I think for me, it was... In the 1960s, as very young, around 10 years old, 11 years old, I came across the work of Erich von Däniken called Chariots of the Gods. And as a very young, as a as a teen, well, I mean, I was a preteen at that time, I was really intrigued by the idea of extraterrestrial life. And I was very influenced by science fiction at that time, you know, whether it was Star Trek or the movies, like one of the most popular movies that really appealed to me at the time was the classic movie, The Day the Earth Stood Still. And you know, like when I saw The Day the Earth Stood Still, something within me recognized that this was real, that there was extraterrestrial life out there, and that one day they would come. And I remember as a youngster that I wanted to become an astronaut. And the reason I wanted to become an astronaut was that I wanted to meet the space people, because I knew that they were coming. I just knew that. It was like an intuition. It was a knowledge that they were coming. And so, yeah, that's how my life journey began, as desiring to become an astronaut and going through university, getting degrees and so forth, thinking that, well, you know, if I do all the right things, I might become an astronaut and meet with the space people. Well, you know, my life took a different turn. I went down a different path. But now, you know, for the last 20 years, I've been working to help awaken people to the reality of extraterrestrial life. And now we've reached the point where extraterrestrials are about to reveal themselves, because we are going to graduate into the galactic community where you know, the secret is going to be revealed. And in a way, it's like I will have realized my life mission of like meeting the space people. Because I think for your generation, you know, this will, like in 5 years, 10 years' time, it'll be normal for you to go out and probably have an interaction with extraterrestrials. But for people from my generation, this was a dream. So it'll be a very emotional thing when it really happens.
Oh my God, that's so wonderful. I just get such good vibes about what you just said, and the way you express that. I can feel the consciousness. And I want to share with you a vision that I had of heaven. It's something that actually happened to me not long ago, maybe a month ago. And it was a very clear vision of heaven. And people, well, I think it's hard for people in general to think about, okay, where is heaven? Like, we all accept heaven is real, but where is it? How do you access it? Like, what is it? And the way it was shown to me, it was that it's basically planets. They are higher dimensional planets. You know, if we focus on our galaxy, like, we can imagine a set of, I don't know, 20 higher dimensional planets that are heavenly planets. And basically, animal and human souls that die here, again, animal and human souls that die here, go to these planets. So the concept of heaven, it became less blurry for a moment, and because they just became, they're planets. They're basically just planets. That's just the simplest explanation. And what's your opinion about that?
Yeah, I think when we look at these concepts of like heaven, like what is heaven? You know, you have that in many religious traditions, heaven, you know, this ideal place. Well, you know, that's often influenced by some extraterrestrial species which has interacted with the founder of that religion. You know, whether we're talking about Moses, or whether we're talking about Jesus, or whether we're talking about Muhammad or the Buddha, that, you know, the conception of heaven is influenced by beings, these off-world beings that would have been regarded as angels or messengers of God. But really, these were highly advanced extraterrestrials helping these kind of like primitive humans develop cultural norms or higher ethics that could help humanity evolve. And the idea of heaven was an important part of that, that they gave a little bit of an idea of what it would be like to live on the home world of that species. And it was very idealistic, And so that was something that was absorbed in those different religious traditions, I believe. And so, yeah, I think when we start to think about heaven, we really are opening up our minds to life on other worlds that has evolved into very high levels of consciousness that, you know, would be almost angelic by our standards.
Yeah, the way I see it, they're almost incomprehensible because of how perfect they are. We can only have a general idea. But I think it's so refreshing that, you know, there's this possibility that is very real to me that, well, life doesn't really end. It mutates. So when animals or humans, life forms, die here, their spirit, their energetic source, it's connected to these planets in different sectors of the galaxy. And they just go there, and that's what heaven is like. And it just the most refreshing thing that has happened to me in the past month. And Dr. Sala, this has been a wonderful conversation, a great honor to have you on Squirrel Snow here. And I just have one last thing, and it is that if you could speak to our Galactic Federation or Galactic Confederation now, if you were on a speakerphone to all fleets stationed in the system, either actual, you know, because they are stationed in different dimensions. So however they are stationed in the system, what would you tell them? You're a speakerphone to all fleets.
We welcome them in peace and love. We are ready to embrace them as our cosmic brothers and sisters. Humanity is prepared to be inspired and to grow and evolve as brothers and sisters in the greater galactic family. And we look forward to this union, reunion with you, because it is something that many of us have been waiting all our lives, and humanity is now ready for this.
Yes, that was wonderful, and a wonderful conversation with you, Dr. Sala, an exclusive here on KBOO 90.7 FM Portland. What a pleasure, and well, we'll see each other again at some point. Thank you so much for your work. Very much appreciated. Is there anything that you would like to share with people? Anything, any information, seminar, new book coming up, anything?
Just people can go to my website, exopolitics.org, and subscribe, and that way they can find out about upcoming events that I'm doing, and new books, and I have a whole library of books and webinars that I've done, so people can just go to the website to find out about those. So thank you, Enda, for having me on your show and for, you know, letting your audience know about these incredible topics.
Oh, great. Thank you, Dr. Sala. It's been a great pleasure.
You're welcome. Okay, all the best, Enda.
You have a great night.
Thank you. Bye-bye.